oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should mention that we are actually not physically in the same studio right now because of COVID-19. We are socially distancing and coming to you via Zoom, and our guest will be coming to us via Zoom today as well.
Dr. Zoom University Pope.
Zoom University.
Yeah, because we're going to be talking about use of online education and higher education as a good portion of this show, I think.
We are. And I have a quiz for you, Dan. During COVID-19, I don't think we did enough quizzes. We were being very serious. This is, I'm going to test your knowledge here.
I have not seen these questions. I have no idea what the content, the topic, but I'm game. Let's do it.
I'm glad you're game. So here is the scoop. We at Challenge Success have been asking high school kids what has been working for them during remote learning and what has not, and particularly what do they most appreciate from the switch. Okay, so I want you to guess, what do you think the top three answers are that the high school students who have now been in remote learning for several months have said that they most appreciate from the switch?
That their parents bought a puppy.
You know what? It's so scary. I know so many people who bought puppies.
I know. And it's a good time to be a dog, I think.
Yes.
Let's see. Students, I think they appreciate asynchronous, that they can do the work not necessarily in class, and they can do it on their own schedule.
That is definitely in the top three. Good job. They really like the freedom. And they also said that they along the same lines here, could go and take a run in between, can go do their job, put in extra hours at work. The asynchronous has opened up a ton of flexibility. So that is definitely in the top three. What else do you think is in the top three?
The chance to have a one-on-one conversation with the teacher over Zoom.
You are good, Dan. That was definitely the top three. It was definitely more individualized attention. Teachers are having office hours, even if it's just by telephone and not, because a lot of these kids don't have Wi-Fi or access to computers, but teachers really reaching out.
Boy, number three. That some of the lessons are using technology in new ways. So like they might have a vocabulary app that they really like, or science simulations. This is a long shot. I'm not confident in this one.
I'm going to not be able to give you an X there. This is the thing. They probably appreciate some of that technology. Some of that technology was probably being used before, but that didn't come up in our conversations. The third top vote getter of what they really appreciated is that teachers were cutting content to just the essentials. And so they were not having to do the same amount, the load of work that they had to do in the past. And by going slower and just trying to cut down on some of what the kids would say busy work, they felt that the load was much more doable, but also they understood why they had to learn certain concepts and didn't think of things as busy work anymore. So that was great.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you think that'll stick? So a big complaint is we're a mile wide and an inch deep. Do you think this will stick, or is it just going to be less content?
So what we have been doing at Challenge Success is taking what the kids said and saying, we hope all of these things stick. We hope the flexibility sticks. We hope that the less is more mentality around content and homework sticks, and we really hope that the teacher-student relationships that were being fostered by these one-on-ones, not only are you getting to learn better, but you actually get to know the teacher better, and the teacher gets to know you better. I mean, they even liked it when they saw like the teacher's pet jump into the screen, or one of the teacher's kids got on screen, or the baby. They just feel like they're seeing a glimpse into real people So those are the lessons from that we're trying to keep going.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I guess the question is, because we're talking about higher ed today, how much of this do you think applies to higher ed? I mean, you've seen at the School of Education even, what are students saying they appreciate? I know there's a lot of downsides too, but what are they saying they most appreciate at the higher ed level?
So for classes that are not massive, right, which take a long time to prepare, you know, a big online course that goes to the world, I think the number one is the faculty who've really stepped up. They really appreciate that. So there's some faculty who've done sort of an amazing job of changing the way they teach to include better multimedia, videos, interactivity, and they really appreciate that the faculty are taking that effort, as opposed to me, who has a yellow pad, which is the same yellow pad I've read from for the last 30 years.
I do not believe that, Dan Schwartz.
Only because I couldn't read my own handwriting. But I think a second thing is the asynchronous nature, that they can do the work at their time, you know, and this is particularly important for, say, international students. Right now, if it was required to be synchronous, a lot of our international students are in very different time zones, and they would have to wake up at like 3 a.m. to take a course. Yeah. So those are two things that have showed up that I think people appreciate. Of course, being in the seat of the dean, I hear most of the things that people don't appreciate.
Yeah. And we hear that from the high school kids too, but
yeah.
But I'm glad we have our expert here for higher ed.
Because, we do. We brought an expert to help educate all of us. So I'm very pleased to welcome back Mitchell Stevens. He's a professor of education at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. He's a sociologist by training, and he studies alternate forms of education, policies, online learning. And he recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called, "What is a College Education in the Time of Coronavirus?" So welcome, Mitchell. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So what's happening out there in adult learning? We'll pivot to college, but tell me about adult learning for people who aren't enrolled in college.
Well, that's been a rapidly evolving sector over the last 10 years, in no small measure because of the ubiquity of broadband internet access, which has substantially lowered the cost of providing adult learning opportunities and made it much easier for adults to take advantage of bits and pieces of learning assembled in forms and on timetables that work for the rhythm of adult lives.
So do they, now that are more people taking courses like with Coursera or other providers at this time?
Two answers to that question. In the wake of COVID-19, there's been a huge spike in subscriptions to online services like the Courseras and edXs of the world. It's a bad time for many parts of the economy, but a very good time for online learning providers. The second answer I would say is that I think we tend to forget just how many learning experiences are now conveyed for free or almost free online. How many of us have not used YouTube to learn how to cook a pork roast or how to change a bicycle tire or how to cut a child's hair? We now just take for granted that there's an ongoing flow of learning opportunities that are so common that we don't even really think of them as learning opportunities per se anymore.
I wholeheartedly agree. I have gone to YouTube to fix a kitchen sink during a time of pandemic because we didn't want to call a plumber. And so, yes, we are very, very grateful for that. And I didn't even think of that as online learning. So this is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Mitchell Stevens today about online learning, adult learning, what's working, what the state of the landscape is now that we have been sheltering in place and really relying on our computers a lot more for education.
So implications for higher ed, people will no longer take course length educational things. They'll take, you know, 1 hour classes, or, you know, what can you see into the future?
Well, I can see halfway to the future. If you think about the future of online learning has having begun with the broad access of online learning to virtually every American, perhaps 15 years ago, higher education has been in a long-term transition from a presumption that face-to-face instruction is really the only, if not the only, the primary way to receive instruction, to one in which multiple platforms or multiple modalities that include face-to-face instruction in a physical classroom, but are by no means limited to it. What happened in around March 15 is that overnight, all face-to-face instruction became online learning. And that was a sort of a radical disjuncture in people's lives and experiences that I think is almost certainly going to have forward consequences, specifically on the presumption that face-to-face instruction is always already superior to digitally mediated forms. I just don't think that presumption is going to be sustainable, regardless of when the pandemic ends.
So does that mean we are going to see some stickiness of online learning in ways that we could not have predicted before? I mean, do you think more colleges, let's say we have a vaccine even, more colleges are going to continue to deliver online?
Yes, absolutely. I would say, you know, again, we are halfway to a multi-platform future. The proportion of courses that students have been taking online overall has steadily grown over the last 5 years. And now a majority of undergraduates before COVID had enrolled in at least one credit-bearing post-secondary course as part of their academic portfolios. So this is only going to speed that process, I would say. The other thing that the pandemic is forcing a new reckoning on is just how much and under what conditions is physical co-presence worth the cost. There's no question that the major cost center of higher education in the United States is what is entailed in having a bunch of people in the same place at the same time for extended stretches of the academic calendar. It's a hugely expensive way of conveying education. And of course, we know since Socrates that face-to-face instruction has special benefits and powers. It's also the case that anyone who has sat through more than a few auditorium lectures knows that not every hour of physical co-presence is equally valuable. And so one of the things that I think we can see going forward is a much more explicit negotiation of how to dose and optimize physical co-presence alongside other more affordable platforms in ways that take advantage of the utility of these different modes of instruction, but at substantially lower opportunity and financial costs to students and their families.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Mitchell Stevens today about the future of higher education, particularly given the lessons we've learned during the pandemic about online instruction. And, you know, Mitchell, you're talking about money. I have heard many college students saying, I want my tuition refunded. I felt like these 3 months of this semester or this quarter were not as good as what I was getting in person. And I know a lot of kids are actually thinking about stopping out and you know, not paying that full tuition if the fall is going to bring more of the same. So
the big fact on this is that people go away to college only very partially for face-to-face instruction. And this may give the educators on you who are listening chagrin, but guess what? The students aren't at college primarily for the pedagogical edification of their faculty. They're there, Denise, for the full tilt wraparound 24/7 residential experience that The excuse we give for that experience is academic instruction, but most of the value of that experience, I would suggest, is it conveyed to students and their families through the social surround of the classroom. And frankly, I think students are and their families are justifiably frustrated that they're being charged the same amount for what is essentially a categorically different service. Again, that's a very hard thing for educators and parents to reckon with. And I think that will have far-reaching consequences for how we think about the value of higher education going forward.
So do you think online will figure out how to replace some of the residential experience?
I won't say replace the residential experience, Dan, although I will say that that educators, like other artists and craftspeople, will be very canny at creating new kinds of experiences through digital media that we can't yet foresee. And actually, again, you know, one of the things I am cautiously optimistic about is we're already seeing a lot of that artistic and pedagogical creativity. I've seen my first live online theatrical performance in recent weeks. People are doing very interesting and creative things with Zoom forums. And as you know, teachers are very canny, creative people. They make do with what circumstances they have. And so I think we're going to see an ongoing evolution of educational culture. And I'm excited to be at Stanford, where I think we have a fighting chance at doing some especially interesting things.
So here's, I think, a big challenge is that a lot of what happens in undergraduate is identity development, right? You get to spend a lot more time with people who have different ideas, new settings, new experiences. You're of the right age. But in the online world, everything is completely intentional, right? Even doing Zoom, I can't talk over you because it'll disrupt everything. So I think that's going to be a challenge for how to have that identity development. So like Stanford has theme houses, you know, if you're an undergraduate, you stay in a theme house. It does a lot of work.
Like a theme, like the African-American theme house or the vegan living, grow your own food theme house. I'm butchering these, but I know we have both of those.
Yes. Where, you know, people have joined together because there's a shared identity at the same time they grow it. But, you know, the online thing is just everything is so intentional. You know, you have to schedule meetings at certain times. The hallway conversations are missing. So I think that's going to be a big thing to figure out how to solve.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Mitchell Stevens talking about higher education and the effects of going online next on SiriusXM.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So it is hard to predict what the future will be.
The focus is really on academics.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Mitchell Stevens today about higher education, particularly higher education and online learning, given all that's been going on during COVID-19.
So Mitchell and Denise, people often wish schools would do more for equity, and I agree with that. There's a lot to be done. At the same time, with the pandemic, we sort of have discovered how much they already do, right? Because now people are at home learning. They don't have equal access. The crowding in their home. We're seeing this at the university level, at all levels. So now we're proposing that everything goes online, right, which will exacerbate those kinds of inequities. The dream of the online was that it would increase access, but then it turns out people can't take advantage of that access. So help me think about this.
I'm glad you raised that, Dan, because face-to-face instruction is paradoxical from an equity standpoint, especially in higher education, I would say. It is the case that schools that have residential programs take great pride, and rightfully so, that their ability to provide wraparound life world for their students substantially remediates the inequalities among the students that have the opportunity to study on those campuses. But it's also the case that that's only about a third of conventionally aged undergraduates experiencing that kind of academic life world. And the reason it's only a third is because that mode of delivery is just spectacularly expensive. So for the relatively fortunate young people who have the opportunity to be supported in that kind of learning environment, the benefits for equity are quite real. But for all of those, the rest who have for whom that mode of instruction is simply unaffordable, online learning really lowers not only the financial but also opportunity costs of college education. If I'm a working mother who's completing an associate's degree in a healthcare field, for example, online, I can discount the time I would have spent driving to and from a college campus, parking, organizing that much more childcare for my children and my family. So there's a way in which everyone going online at this particular moment is kind of throwing into abeyance some different cost structures that we've long taken for granted, whether or not they were equitable arrangements.
So, Denise, does that argument hold for K-12? You know, my kid goes to public school, and the public schools, they should be able to save money by going online and therefore things to reduce inequities?
It's a little bit different in K-12, and here's why. Because the K-12 schools have still been providing food for people. So the colleges are sending people home, or if you can't afford to go home and you're at a wealthier college, they're taking care of you and letting you stay there. But for K-12 public schools, they have not cut their costs in terms of having to feed people, and they still have union issues. So we have both very poor and very wealthy public schools whose unions have said, we're not going to do online instruction for a whole host of reasons. So in some of the districts, they're not doing online instruction, and they're just giving out packets because of this equity issue, because not everybody can get online and they can't afford to give everybody's computers and Wi-Fi, right? But they also have, in wealthy districts, union folks are saying, this is not fair to the teachers. This is above and beyond. They don't have childcare. They don't have an ability to do this, and it's above and beyond sort of the normal workload. So it's a little bit different from higher ed. Mitchell, what do you think?
Well, and I think another very important question from an equity and social policy standpoint now is most of our conceptions of education as a right have been predicated on access to a physical facility. But we may now need to think about the rights of educational provision as extending to broadband as well. Whose responsibility is it that every child in America has stable access to an internet? And is there a bare threshold for broadband or connectivity? Those are questions of education policy that we will almost certainly have to reckon with in the coming months and years.
Yeah, and I want to let people know, too, it's not just the kids who don't have the access. Many, many teachers don't have the access either. I had a school district who said they had to give out more hotspots to teachers than students. So this is everybody involved in education needs that equity. Mm-hmm. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Mitchell Stevens about online education, particularly in higher education, and some of the issues around equity that we're seeing.
So I actually, before we finish, I have to ask Mitchell, who did a lot of work on homeschooling, which is kind of the original social distancing. So are they going to come to the rescue with all sorts of tips for how we can do this better?
Wait, who are they?
The homeschoolers?
Parents who have homeschooled their kids are going to come to the rescue of the rest.
And there's all sorts of consortiums of people doing this, but
homeschoolers are an especially prescient group of Americans. Homeschooled children represent about 3.5% of the school age population in the United States. But these families
that's 3.5%.
3.5% of the total school age population. But these families have had influence on educational culture far in excess of their numbers. They very substantially anticipated what is now conventional wisdom in schools of education about constructivist and child-directed learning. Homeschoolers were doing that 40 years ago full-time. In fact, they were so invested in child-directed learning that many of them didn't like the idea of teachers in conventional classrooms at all. They thought that organization of schooling was too hierarchical for young people's essential needs and abilities. And there were other homeschoolers, conservative Protestant Christians, who were in fact the first social distancers, and they were skeptical of school, not because they were hierarchical and authoritarian places, but because the wrong people were in front of the classroom, and that their children might be, in fact, morally at risk if they were exposed to people with beliefs too far from their own. So, in this very interesting way, on both the right and left, I think we are seeing magnified in this moment those same. Constraints and debates in educational culture.
Yeah, and I would say too that, you know, many parents are saying, I did not choose to be a homeschooler. So we're actually very careful not to call what's going on right now in any way, shape, or form homeschooling, even though learning is happening at home, because it's not the same. The parents are saying, we did not choose. A homeschooling mom chooses this. A homeschooling dad chooses this. We didn't choose it. We're not equipped. And also, I know that the state has to do certain things to approve homeschooling curriculum, right? It's not like just a total free-for-all. And right now, in many places, just because schools aren't sending, you know, I just read that about a third of all rural schools across the U.S. have sent nothing home. Not their fault, just that we're not in the position to get it together. So that would not be approved by people checking in on homeschooling. So I just want to make sure that we're not conflating.
But in Mitchell's world of the future, where we're all learning online, K-12, suddenly you're going to be able to niche pick, right? You're going to be able to go to the school that is the choice of your interests.
Another issue that I very much hope the pandemic raises is the ongoing inequality between mothers and fathers and who is taking care of children. I just read a headline this morning that informed me that 70% of the child care that's happening in the United States at present is being purveyed by working mothers.
Thank you so much, Mitchell. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.